Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
All right, here we go. Quiet! Problem!
You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it, pull it down.
Mr. Allen, this may come as a shock to you, but there are some men who don't end every sentence with a proposition.
All right, I'll jump first.
Nope.
Then you jump first.
No, I said.
What's the matter with you?
I can't swim!
I don't like that music anymore. Mind if I close the window?
Every one of you listening to my voice, tell the world, watch the skies everywhere. Keep looking. Keep watching the skies.
Well, here's another nice mess you've gotten me into.
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105 Radio across the city and South Cambridgeshire. Many thanks to Ian for the past 2 hours, but now it's time for Bums on Seats, a guide to what's now showing at the only cool place left on planet Earth, the cinema. My name is Yossi Osman and my reviews in the studio are April McIntyre.
Hello.
Dave Riley.
Afternoon.
And Rowan Lamb.
Hello.
Today's show starts by the sea and ends with risking life and limb. The songs of ABBA are once again in full flow in Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, while Tom Cruise can barely sit still for a moment in the relentless Mission Impossible fallout. We'll also review the new British drama Apostasy, find out a little about the revolutionary filmmaking of Agnès Varda, and have a preview of August's Movies on the Meadow. So, oodles to come? But we start by making a right song and dance over love.
I don't know what my future holds, but the world is wide. I want to make some memories. There's an island, Kalikari. People used to think if you sailed on from there, you'd fall off the edge of the world. That sounds like the place for me.
I'm Bill.
I'm Donna. He is literally the handsomest man in the world. Except for this guy. What kind of island is this?
Can I help?
Woo!
This whole place is incredible.
I think we should stay here together.
May the rest of our lives be the best of our lives.
All three of us are grandfathers, and that's that.
Look what you've done with the place.
She wanted to make her mum proud.
If she hasn't done that all her life.
Can't tell anybody about the baby yet.
I just told Bill.
Yeah, and I told Harry.
I told many, many people.
The huge success of Mamma Mia was a reminder that there's always an audience for the life-affirming musical. Based around the songs of ABBA, set in the Mediterranean sunshine, and graced by an energetic Meryl Streep, the film hit that sweet spot between big Hollywood production and a sing-along you can have with your friends. Now on general release, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again opens 5 years on from the first film. Meryl Streep's Donna has passed away, leaving her daughter Sophie, played once again by Amanda Seyfried, to run her beautiful Greek island hotel. But Sophie is struggling. Her marriage is on the rocks and she's worried about facing impending motherhood on her own. Problems even the power of songs may not be able to help with. April. Mamma Mia 2 comes 10 years after the huge success of the first film. So, voulez-vous recommend it to our listeners, or is it all just for the money, money, money? Apologies for that question.
Voulez-vous recommend, definitely. So, as you said before, the story follows Donna's daughter, Sophie, as she learns to navigate a world without her mother. The film is peppered with these lovely flashbacks to stories about Donna back in the 70s as she discovers a new life in Greece and ultimately how Sophie came into being. As Sophie realises then she's walking a similar path her mother did when she was her age. And this one's directed by Ol Parker, who we'd have seen Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. And the first one was directed by Phyllida Lloyd, who firstly a theatre director with recent productions, including the all-female Shakespeare trilogy at the Donmar Warehouse. She's really seasoned in stage adaptation. I think that is the difference between the two films. I found that this one, I loved the first one, and so I was really looking forward to this one. And I think that it seemed more so that the songs led the story a little bit in this one. which meant that there were some things that happened that I felt just happened to include a specific song. And I didn't find that that was quite the same as the first. The first one seemed a little bit more seamless. But regardless of that, I absolutely loved it. It has songs, it has fun, it has Cher. So, and I did get a bit teary at the end, and I'm sure plenty of other people that have gone to see it will also have cried a little bit.
Including myself. I may be biased because I knew I was going to love it before I even saw it. Would you say, just thinking about Phyllis Deloyd and what she brought to the first one, because you said she's got a background in stage, that one felt a bit more like a musical, whereas this one feels a bit more like a film with songs in it?
Yeah, because she has that experience. I think coming from a stage background, it did seem a little bit more seamless because essentially the film is sort of more musical, but this one definitely feels more film with musical elements added in, which were great, but I think maybe they didn't fit quite as seamlessly in as the first one felt like they did anyway.
That's interesting, Dave, because the first one had a lot of ABBA's big hits, the songs that we all know and love and, you know, happy to sing along to, and that actually does come from the stage, the West End / Broadway production. The second film had to use some of their B-sides, for example, some of their lesser known songs. Do they really fit in with the narrative, or did it, you know, well, what did they bring?
It's funny because I had the exact opposite feeling to April. When I saw the first one, I thought, oh, some of these songs feel like they've just kind of hammered them into place. You know, and also, you know, with Pierce Brosnan singing, anything felt hammered in place. Oh, God. They've toned down his volume control this time around.
Which is such a shame.
Well, I actually thought it suited him better because he gets to do some lovely kind of little somber songs to himself and he's in the choir. And, you know, I wasn't crying. I was allergic to the dogs in the screen with me. This is my story. I'm sticking to it.
I thought
it actually felt more like a story this time, and that the songs didn't lead the story so much as the story led the songs. And it did give the opportunity for some of their less well-known songs, but a lot of their less well-known songs are a lot of the better songs in themselves. Angel Eyes, I think, is an absolute masterpiece of a song. And this is a criticism I shared with my dad on the first film. It's like the first film's all the big numbers, and it's like, if they ever do a sequel, they're not going to have any of the big rousing songs left. And then we suddenly realised, oh, that's because they'll just have the brilliant music left. Oh, well, that's fine by us then. So when it did turn out that way, I was really happy. And another nice thing they did was they used motifs in the instrumentals in the background of the songs from the first film, just to kind of cast your memory back. So Pierce Brosnan, when he does sing, he sings a muted version of SOS, which was his and Meryl Streep's big number together in the first film. Really nice little touches, I thought.
Yeah, there's some really beautiful songs in the film and some really gorgeous moments. We've all had a little cry, it seems. Okay, Dave, maybe not. Maybe you just had an allergic reaction. But towards the end in particular, there are some really lovely moments that might be kind of, that might inspire some tears, particularly when we see Meryl Streep, who's not in this film a lot. Do we miss her presence?
I would say she was the driving force of the first film. But I found a lot of the kind of energy and enthusiasm in this one came from the cast they brought in to play the younger versions of all the characters. Lily James, as a young Meryl Streep, is absolutely fantastic. She's seen what she's done with the character in the first film, and she's actually really channeled it into herself. And I was like, yeah, I can believe this is the same person, but however many years, when's it set? Is it in the 70s is when she's meant to be at college? So it's 30-year gap, and it's like, yeah, this feels like the same person. They've got the same kind of enthusiasm for life that I would like to believe Donna's character, Meryl Streep's character Donna, had, even right up to whatever end it was. They never go into specific details, and that's another thing I like. It makes it feel like, you know, she's gone, but in no way is she forgotten at all. And yeah, that's a lovely thing to do.
Yeah. When we think about the kind of narrative elements, I know that's probably not your main driving force for going to see Mamma Mia 2, but the kind of linking Sophie, Amanda Seyfried's character's story, with the young Donna's story, there's kind of some intertwining moments there. Did it come across a little bit too corny, or did it kind of work in the whole?
Can you come across too corny in Mamma Mia? I don't think you can. I really liked that she was sort of in the same place as her mum was, and there was this the shared feeling of sort of having to maybe go it alone. And I really like that. I like that crossover. I thought it worked, definitely, for me.
Great. And then, of course, you know, all the old favourites are around. You've got, you know, Pierce and Colin and Christine Baranski. Sorry, I've forgotten their names temporarily. and their younger versions. And it's very much, especially towards the end, it's like a whole everybody's back. But then we have Cher, who, I don't know about you guys, but when I saw the trailer, I was super excited that Cher was going to be in the film. However, she, again, she's not really in it much. What do you think she brings to the Mamma Mia franchise?
She brings Cher.
She brings Cher.
I'm not sure what else. Her rendition of Fernando was epic.
It was very good.
Probably one of my favourite parts.
But is she believable as her character?
In the universe of the film, I guess maybe. I guess you can kind of see like this relationship that then Donna and Sophie had, how that sort of evolved from the way that Cher's character is as the grandmother. But then she gets all lovey-dovey and gooey towards the end, and that's nice.
Excellent. So what do we think about the possibility of a Mamma Mia 3? Does it have anything left to give?
How many songs do they have left?
I don't know. I'd really have to ask my dad. He's the expert on this. I mean, I remember driving in a car when I was a kid. This is one of the reasons I actually love the film. So the music was a background to my childhood because of Mum and Dad. But I really don't know if they'd be able to do it again without kind of mucking it up completely. It's one of those ones. It's like lightning has now struck twice.
Literally.
And I would actually say that the second film is even better than the first film because I like the story more. Na-na-na-na-na. But could they do it a third time? I don't know. Pierce Brosnan might try and sing loudly again and I just kind of run screaming from the cinema.
What I was hoping for. I missed his screaming of SOS. April, you liked the first one more, didn't you?
I did.
So do you think that two's enough?
I think one is always enough in most cases. But I think with this type of film, they've got a lot of possibilities of where they can move forward. For example, you could have something with Sophie with a child moving forward in the world, or you could go far-flung into the future and have her child doing the same thing, but then it would maybe just be a big repetitive...
It'd be like a Mamma Mia family tree.
It would.
Which perhaps
it would never
we don't
end.
Need.
Having babies and following them in Greece.
It was the bit at the end where Cher's character suddenly realises she's great-grandma. She's only just accepted being a grandma. There are some possibilities there, but I think they played them all out in that space of 30 seconds where she just kind of goes, oh boy, and then is happy again.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, it's a great, fun watch at the cinema. So Mamma Mia 2, Here We Go Again, opened last week, and it's still showing at all three Cambridge cinemas. It's a certificate PG. Next Thursday, the cinema highlight of the summer, a season of films by the great French director Agnès Varda, starts. Consisting of 9 movies, the season is a perfect opportunity to catch up with a filmmaker who has been a vital voice of world cinema for the past 60 years. To find out a little bit more about Agnès Varda, we spoke to Selena Robertson, co-founder of Club des Femmes, a queer feminist group who curate film screenings and events. With help from the Independent Cinema Office, Club des Femmes is currently touring Revolt, She Said, a collection of female-directed movies that illustrate the fierce artistic change that followed the revolutions of May 1968. This tour includes the Agnès Varda film One Sings, The Other Doesn't, a warm drama about female friendship and the political fight for birth control. Selena talked about how Varda had been sidelined by French cinema, but she began by explaining the origin of both Club des Femmes and the Revolt, She Said film tour.
Well, Club des Femmes, we started in 2007, 11 years ago now. And it was myself and a friend of mine called Sarah Wood, who lives in Cambridge, actually. She's an artist, filmmaker and curator. And we were sort of frustrated at the time in London because apart from sort of BFI flares, there wasn't anything else at any time around the year of the opportunity to watch sort of experimental feminist cinema or sort of queer sort of avant-garde films. And so we decided to basically sort of form a film club, and we called ourselves Club des Femmes, and we had our first screening at Curzon Soho. And then we just sort of continued, really. I mean, it was basically putting on screenings for films that we wanted to sort of bring back to the cinema and invited our friends. And then it just sort of built and built. And this tour that we're doing at the moment, Revolt, She Said, Women and Film Post 68, this is basically our highest profile project. And we're doing it in partnership with the ICO. What we wanted to do with the tour is reflect back on this very rich history of kind of feminist and queer cinema that might not have been traced so clearly back to kind of May 68. What we're saying is from that time, the women's movement was founded, and that's arguably kind of the most radical kind of social revolution of the 20th century.
In any discussion with, say, experimental or avant-garde music, there's an accepted canon that is entirely male. And that's because the canon has been dictated by predominantly male critics. I wondered if that was the same case with experimental and radical filmmakers. Is film history in that area selected along gender lines?
Yes, I'm afraid. I mean, there has been a history of that. And, you know, it comes back to who are the gatekeepers of that history. You know, for us, we want to say there's been a very rich history of women and the avant-garde that feminist filmmakers have been writing about since the 70s. I'm thinking of people like Maya Deren, Germaine Dulac, Yvonne Rainer, Margaret Tate, Julie Dash. Feminist historians and critics have been kind of writing about and programming these filmmakers since the 70s. It's just that they have traditionally been kind of written out of existence. And also written out of being influential.
C'est donc si grave.
J'ai vu le cancer. Elle est perdue.
Si c'est ça, je me tuerai.
Encore un truc pour qu'on te dise qu'on t'aime.
Il me fatigue avec son emploi du temps, j'ai envie de le laisser.
That unbalance, it leads me to Agnes Varda. You have one Varda film in your current tour, one sings and the other doesn't. And I know she's having a moment in the sun now, but her role in French cinema seems to be significantly downplayed.
I mean, she has always traditionally been sort of seen somewhat as a sort of adjunct to the new wave. You know, she's sort of in her sixth decade of artistic practice. You know, she's not only a filmmaker, you know, she's a photographer. She's a writer, she draws, and she's now also a visual artist. So Agnes Varda, she made a film in 1954 called La Pointe Courte, and it is now being sort of considered as a sort of preempting kind of the new wave, you know, people like Godard, Truffaut and Rivette, because of the sort of her intellectual and aesthetic kind of ambitions in the film. Yes, I think she has been sidelined, but she's always someone who's actually been quite open and happy to be on the margins. But I want to sort of stress that feminists have always kind of placed her in the centre, but it's always been sort of the sort of male kind of mainstream canon who have kind of put her to kind of one side.
But is there, just to keep within the French New Wave and Agnes Varda, a knock-on effect in having a male-dominated canon that perpetuates a female stereotype within what seems, to somebody like me, a progressive framework. When I became a film buff, gradually you're introduced to one genre or one group of filmmakers after another, and you get the French New Wave, and you get Truffaut and Godard, and then Rivette, and you say, and you feel like you've accomplished something, but then you see Varda's films, and you realise, well, hold on, these other filmmakers are still presenting an idealised form of female character.
Well, that's why we need a more diverse film culture. Because then, you know, we're having more diverse stories and a greater kind of level of representation. I mean, I think that was something that you mentioned before about one thing, that you love the kind of the way she picks up and represents the everyday, and how things that you wouldn't notice in other films that, you know, Agnès Varda kind of really touches on, things like breastfeeding or knitting or letter writing, you know, postcard writing, and sort of the power and the kind of the intimacy kind of female friendship. And Agnès Varda, she's much more interested in kind of the real, you know, the sort of the everyday woman, and not an image that's kind of projected or manufactured or kind of produced in some way.
This new BFI tour, is it important to remind people of her political activism? She is much more of a cultural figure now, but her age can be used to sort of defang her feminism a little bit. You see pictures of her with her cat, and suddenly the activism side seems to be downplayed a little bit.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Varda's always been very outspoken about the fact that she's a feminist. And still, I sort of feel that that's quite a radical act, you know, because still, there's a lot of filmmakers today who won't acknowledge their sort of political activism. And I think you can't ignore the fact that she's 90. And yes, you know, she's always allied with her cat. But I think, you know, her activism, you can see in her sort of, in the films that she's made. I mean, one thing is the most, I guess, predominantly feminist film that she made. But then you've got something like Vagabond that she made in the 80s, which is an extraordinary film about a young woman's sort of desire to live free. But I think also she's now, Varda has now sort of become a sort of a touchstone for many sort of debates in film culture, you know, around in the Me Too kind of era. And, you know, she's again being kind of reappraised by the mainstream. But she, as I said, has always said that she wants to work outside of the mainstream, and she's very, very sort of happy of working within the margins. I mean, it's great that she's you know, that she's having this kind of moment again and kind of being reappraised as not only sort of the mother of French cinema, you know, as a pioneer really of kind of post-war French cinema.
Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Many thanks to Selena Robertson for the interview and to Rebecca Del Tufo of Saffron Screen for helping us to arrange it. And it's at Saffron Screen this coming Monday that Club de Femme is offering a rare chance to see Daisies, a hugely influential feminist punk masterpiece from 1967. And the Agnès Varda season starts at the Arts Picture House this Thursday at 6:30 with a chance to see her very first film, La Pointe Courte. More details are on pages 28 and 29 of the current Arts Picture House brochure, which you can pick up at the Picture House.
If you like books, writing, fiction, non-fiction, poetry, drama, and chat with authors from Cambridge and beyond, then save the page to bookmark every other Saturday at 1 p.m. with me, Lee Chambers, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Want to catch up with one of your favourite shows or interviews? Listen to a variety of them again on our website. Find out what's best on the food and drink scene in Cambridge with Flavour, film reviews with Bums on Seats, or the best of the guests from 105 Daytime. Those and many more are available to download now at cambridge105.fm.
Cambridge has a vibrant food and drink scene. On Flavour, we talk with a wide range of food and drink producers. We visit cafes, restaurants, pubs, and independent food stores. We find out what's new and what's good. We review the food items in the papers. If it's about food and drink, if it's local and good, it's on Flavour. Alternate Saturdays, 12 till 1, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Still to come on today's Bums on Seats, we've a report on next month's Movies on the Meadow and a review of Mission Impossible Fallout. But first, we're losing our religion.
I'm Stephen. I'm a new elder here, serving where the need is great.
Now people say things about us.
People are bitter.
Some brothers believed Armageddon was supposed to come in 1975.
It's okay to have doubts. Is it okay if I start helping out just with a few practical things?
We must avoid socialising with the wrongdoer.
What's the problem?
She likes to voice her own opinions too much.
Do you know how it feels to think Jehovah is punishing you all the time? Do you think it's right how they make you treat me?
You might beg Jehovah, why do this to me and my family? Jesus stated that his work could cause conflict in the household.
Mom, what are you doing?
We must put Jehovah first, even before our family.
The debut of British writer and director Daniel Cocotallo, new release Apostasy is a drama inspired by his own upbringing within the Jehovah's Witnesses religion. Siobhan Finneran plays Ivana, a lifelong devotee of the faith and a steadfast servant of a crumbling church in the suburbs of Oldham. She has two teenage daughters, Louisa and Alex, both just beginning to venture into the wider world. Louisa, played by Sasha Parkinson, is in her first year at university and has a boyfriend she keeps secret. Meanwhile, Alex, played by Molly Wright, wishes to embrace her religion, but a blood transfusion when just a baby means the church has never truly accepted her as one of its own. Rowan, as mentioned, Apostasy is the debut film by Daniel Cocotallo. He wrote it and he directed it, and it's inspired by his own personal experiences. How does it fare as a debut, and what do his personal experiences bring to the film?
Well, as a debut, I think it's incredibly strong. I think he's done well to limit his ambition, perhaps you might say. It's obviously a very intimate film, very small production. But I think it benefits from that because you get a real insight into this family's life that that feels, as I say, very, very intimate, very close. I don't know very much about Jehovah's Witnesses, but the depiction of the religion, the depiction of the community around that religion seems to be accurate, seems to be very heartfelt. But obviously it has its deeper and darker implications for the family as well. But yeah, I think it's an incredibly strong debut for him.
April, you've seen it as well. And going on from that, because Cocotallo, he said that despite what happens in the film and despite his own experiences, he tried to give quite a balanced depiction of Jehovah's Witnesses. How well do you think he does that?
I think in what could almost have been a documentary in some ways, he's humanised the characters a lot more. I think he could have easily gone down that route of documentary because it verges on that at points, but he's humanised the characters and it's a look into a religion that I don't know much about at all. And I think if maybe you're not a Jehovah's Witness, you might not know a lot about either. So I think he, although there are darker elements of it and there are points where you're sort of thinking, you know, this is a very difficult place to be for a family, you also see how Ivana is torn between sort of putting her religion and family first and, you know, as part of the religion to put, you know, your brothers and sisters and the religion first is something that most people do, but it takes this personal approach by showing both of her daughters sort of you know, they're antitheses of each other in a way. And it's then wanting to support her, her daughter that's been sent away from the religion for having this encounter with a worldly boy. And it's then her fighting with her religion and her want and need to be a mother. So I think it does balance it quite well.
Yeah.
And I think...
Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I think Ivana's character definitely sort of strikes that balance.
Yeah. I would agree that the kind of strength of the film is, you know, I'm the same. I don't know much about the Jehovah's Witnesses, but it's about the kind of impact on the family and how they are all kind of wrestling their devotion to the religion with things that are going on in their lives and their roles as mothers or sisters or daughters. And I think a lot of that probably comes down to, well, I guess the writing, but also the performances of the three main actors in the film. Can we just talk about that for a second?
Yeah, I think all three performances are absolutely incredible. Yossi, we've discussed this off air.
Yes.
Siobhan Finneran is magnificent in almost anything she touches, and she doesn't disappoint in this one. I think she is brilliant at depicting that sort of crushing dichotomy that she's faced with, the choice between the religion and the family, and the way that unravels for her over the course of the film is heartbreaking to watch. Just, I want to make a small point about the thing you said about how he wanted to give a measured and sort of like balanced depiction of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Perhaps I was bringing my own prejudice, might be a strong word, but my own ideas, my own opinions. It seemed like, for want of a better word, a very cruel religion, and I didn't see much balance. And so I think I'd be interested to hear from someone who is more familiar with the religion and what they thought about that. The performances of the supporting cast I thought were also amazing. The leads are all female, and all of the sort of what you might call antagonists are all male. And that sort of quiet menace that they brought, I thought, was equally good.
It's interesting you say that. I mean, I don't think he's trying to give a positive view of the Jehovah's Witnesses, especially when we look at some of the key subplots, thinking of the blood transfusion, for example, and how a couple of the characters are treated. But I don't know about you guys, but I never felt like I hated anyone in that film. We've been looking at the main characters. You know, I never... Maybe there are some kind of background characters that are... Like you say, the menacing, particularly male, prominent characters that we see. But I could totally understand from the family's perspective where this was coming from, where their devotion was coming from, the sense of community that they were feeling. And I don't know, I think that was quite an interesting thing. And I think part of that is also there's not really much emotion in the film. There are maybe two, three key bits where one of the characters shows a lot of emotion, but it's very... understated. Do you think that that kind of adds to the whole kind of visceral feeling of the film?
I think Siobhan Finneran's character just is so vacant and haunted, and she's a woman that seems completely powerless in this religion. And I think that
well, another point I would bring, because actually we're thinking of that. No, don't worry at all, because another thing, I don't know what you think about this, but the narrative has a couple of key moments. I'm thinking of the end of the film and a very key point in the middle of the film where there's quite a shocking thing that happens.
What, a real gut punch.
Real gut punch. What does that kind of bring, and how did that affect the film for you? Because I think for some people it might be too much.
I think, for some people it might be. I think to April's point about the sort of the lack of emotion and the lack of sort of the passivity of the main character, I sort of consider the mother as the main character in this film almost, and her sort of passive acceptance of these these rules handed down to her, and then the sudden sort of crushing moments or the sudden twists and turns that this film takes, I think. It's a very nicely measured way of sort of affecting the viewer. You sort of coast along with this film at the beginning. It's quite slow to start, and you think, okay, I can understand what this kind of film is about. This is the way this film is going to be. This is going to be an interesting exploration of this religion. Oh boy. And then suddenly you get that gut punch, and I found it very affecting. I watched it at home, actually, and yeah, I was on my own, and I actually said out loud, crikey, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. I would agree there. They were very shocking. And April, you and I had a chat about the end of the film and how that was also quite shocking, against, well, I mean, considering the fact that the whole film is quite dark, that was quite a dark ending to have as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think we have this perception of women as being maternal, and there are points in the film where the character of Ivana may not come across that way, but then there is a point near the end where it did sort of give me the willies a little bit, like just at the end there, and there is a specific scene, and I don't know whether you said that you didn't think it was quite as hard hitting, maybe as
I had such sympathy, like Yossi said, with all of the main characters, that I could understand on a visceral level exactly what was going through their minds at every point. I think the film really is successful in making you feel sympathy for these people that you would normally want to go, you fools, why are you acting this way? But you can really sense why it is they're behaving the way they are. Which I guess is a result of excellent acting and a really decent script.
And even the way it's filmed is so suffocating as well.
So, you know, close up.
Heads fill the screen all the time.
The way that the framing works, I've got a particular interest in this kind of thing, and the way that the characters are framed, the heads are low in the frame all the time. There's an oppressive energy coming down from the top of the screen all the time. It's very well made in a very subtle way.
Great. I think that's a great way to close this one. So Apostasy is due to open at the Arts Picture House on Friday the 10th of August, but you can watch it now if you are interested from our review by going on Curzon Online. It's about 3 months until the 38th Cambridge Film Festival, very exciting, which means it's very nearly time for Movies on the Meadows, the festival's traditional curtain raiser. Held over the long weekends of the August bank holiday, Movies on the Meadows is four evenings of blockbuster and cult films screened on the famous greens of Grantchester Meadows. Arranged by the Cambridge Film Trust, the event is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, outdoor screenings in the UK. To find out a little bit more about the event, Toby Miller spoke to Owen Baker, Marketing and Communications Manager for the Film Trust. To start with, Owen explained what he thought set Movies on the Meadows apart from the current trend in outdoor movies.
I think with Movies on the Meadows, if I'm honest, specifically with scale, I mean, there is a different scale of event at Grantchester in August with Movies on the Meadows than there is with the other operators providing outdoor cinema in Cambridge and Cambridgeshire. It's a big event, a lot of logistical challenges with it, but we try and keep it as informal and welcoming as possible. So it's a bring a picnic type affair rather than, you know, we try and remove the sort of corporate element to it, so it's a really informal family kind of atmosphere. We like to think that Movies on the Meadows in Grantchester is a great example of outdoor cinema at its best. Huge communal experience, you know, 1,000 people a night watching brilliant films in hopefully wonderful weather, and the response is fantastic. I mean, everyone loves it. People come back. It's wonderful.
You remind me again about the screening setup. They're inflatable. You've got three inflatable screens. Are they the other side of the river camp?
So like you say, three inflatable screens. One large field with a river running across one end. One's the biggest screen on the other side of the river, because that way it's far enough away that you're not right up against it. And then screens either side within the field, either side of the field, if you like. And so a horseshoe of screens. And then when people arrive, they are given a radio and they tune in on the radio to whichever channel refers to the screen that they're watching. It really is a fairly extraordinary experience being in the field, particularly once it gets dark and all the films are playing, because there's a best part of 1,000 people sat in the field watching films, and it's completely silent because everyone's listening to it through headphones. It is a fairly magical experience, actually.
Okay, so to concentrate on this August bank holiday over the 4 evenings, what do you have screening? I think there's a couple of films still to be announced. I'm not sure where we are on that.
They're all on sale now, but the first night's selling very well. Greatest Showman, Coco, which is a beautiful Pixar animation. Then Avengers Infinity War, Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, which is the remake, reboot of Jumanji. Paddington 2 and Dunkirk on the Sunday night. And then on the Monday, Ready Player One, Isle of Dogs, Wes Anderson's new film, or newest film, and Steven Spielberg's first film, which he actually made for TV, but in 1971, I think, which is Duel, which is a brilliant thriller.
Operator.
I'd like to report a truck driver that's been endangering my life.
Is there an effort, they're always on the, out of the 3 films per night, to choose something that's a little bit of an outlier?
Yes, I would say that there definitely is. Like you say, there's generally a film each night that, if you like, picks itself, so Greatest Showman or Avengers. We always try and have some, if you like, cult classics, which are this year's Duel in the part, and
Local Hero, I would have thought. Nobody going to this, very few people going to the Meadows will have seen Local Hero at the cinema. It's not even on television any longer.
No. And so there's always the desire to have some cult classics, and then ideally some family films. And I think this year Mary and the Witch's Flower is a great example. Incredibly well received, perhaps not seen by as big an audience as it should have been. Well, it's an opportunity for people to come and see that in an interesting setting, maybe in a setting that offers something that draws them in. Come and see a film that we loved as a festival team, we loved, but that perhaps didn't get the viewings that it should have done.
Movies on the Meadow is very much the starter's pistol on Cambridge Film Festival. This year is the 38th Film Festival. Have you announced the dates yet?
We have. The festival this year, the main film festival, will run this year from October the 25th until November the 1st. I think it's the latest that we've ever done it by a week. It's moved a week later this year out of the half-term holidays to avoid clashing with London Film Festival, which has itself moved a week later. And like you say, you're quite right that the Movies on the Meadows really is a sort of starter event for that, for our whole busiest period. And I think also it's quite nice to flag up that it's also a fundraiser for the festival. We are a charity. We operate, we're completely independent of pitch houses or where we're predominantly based. And Movies on the Meadows is an absolutely vital part of our income that helps us, enables us to run the film festival in October. We're excited about this year's festival. Like I say, end of October. Programming is happening as we speak. The programming team are out at festivals and watching films and watching screeners of films and hopefully finding the 150, 200 best films out there this year.
Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Many thanks to Owen for the interview. More details, including ticket prices and booking details, may be found on the Movies of the Meadow website of Cambridge, www.cambridgefilmfestival.org.uk. We end the show with the threat of the end of the world, an apocalyptic possibility that only Tom Cruise and his Impossible Missions Force have a chance of preventing.
Solomon Lane escaped in Paris.
And now the world is at risk.
This is the CIA's mission. You use a scalpel. I prefer a hammer.
When the clock stops, Ethan Hunt will lose everyone he ever cared about.
You don't understand what you're involved in.
You need to walk away.
Ethan, that's not who we are.
Maybe I'm
Maybe we need to reconsider that. Accept it, Ethan. You've lost this one. What's done is done.
What's done is done when we say it's done.
The sixth film in the Mission Impossible series, Mission Impossible Fallout, is by far the most bruising blockbuster of the summer. The film picks up pretty much where the last movie, Rogue Nation, left off, with the arrest of their anarchist Solomon Lane, a new terrorist group, the Apostles, have risen up. Their plan is to detonate 3 nuclear bombs in 3 cities, a threat made more likely after Ethan Hunt fails in his mission to stop the sale of weapons-grade plutonium. Dave, come to you on this one. Mission Impossible Fallout, it is number 6 in the franchise. What sets it apart, if anything?
It's very difficult to set it apart, but at the same time, there is something that immediately does so, and that's that for the first time, they have kind of done a direct sequel. Now, Tom Cruise was interviewed after, I can't remember if it was after the 4th or 5th film, and he said, I like the idea that these are all kind of standalone films. You know, the cast rotates quite a bit. You've got a few returning characters like Ving Rhames. But one of the things they've never had returning female characters. This time we've got Rebecca Ferguson back again as Ilsa Faust and, you know, completely acting everyone else off the screen whenever she wants to, which is absolutely brilliant. Michelle Monaghan from Mission Impossible 3 is back, not just in a cameo role, they've actually bothered to give her some lines this time around. We've got Solomon Lane, Sean Harris, back in villain form, and I think he's absolutely brilliant because when he did Prometheus, he came away from Prometheus going, I never want to do a big blockbuster again. Can't imagine why, having seen Prometheus. And then they got him in to do Rogue Nation as this kind of enigmatic cell leader who hides in the shadows. First thing he does is turn up in front of Tom Cruise, gas him and shoot one of his friends. And it's like, whoa. And then he's back in this one. They've captured him. Well, trust me, it doesn't stay that way for long, does it? And it's just absolutely kick butt. There's no other way to put it. It got started and it never really stopped until the end. And I sat through the end credits as well because even the music, it just felt like everything had been given a reshuffle, a reboost and reinvigoration. And they'd done it by calling back across all the previous 5 films and saying, what can we do with all of this? And one of the scenes very early on just reminds you of the opening scene in the very first film where they're interrogating someone by everyone acting, and it's just, it's absolutely brilliant.
Also, we'll come to your point about it being kick butt, as you said, a bit late, but I've got a question because we were just chatting off air. I genuinely couldn't remember which Mission Impossible films I'd seen before this because to me they all kind of blur. Do you think that you need to have some knowledge of the Mission Impossible franchise that you need to have seen? I don't know who here has seen which ones, but do you think you need to have seen a lot of them?
I certainly think you benefit from having seen Rogue Nation. As Dave points out, there are lots of returning characters. The first one is very firmly the first one, if that makes sense. But the rest of the films you can watch almost in any order and enjoy them for what they are. But yes, certainly if you can come with the knowledge of Rogue Nation into this one, I think you get a richer experience. But that's not to say that this film won't make sense if you haven't seen that. They do a very efficient job of setting up the scenario at the very beginning, almost as a previously on Mission Impossible. Very quickly done. And this story is self-contained. You know, they explain very quickly that the threat of nuclear warfare is right there, and Ethan Hunt and his friends have to save the day again. I have to echo Dave's thoughts. I thought this film was magnificent. It certainly did kick butt. I'm a big Mission Impossible fan, so I've seen them all.
And for you, is this one of the best ones, would you say?
I can't tell you which my favourite one is.
Ooh.
It's almost the last one you see is the favourite film when it comes to the Mission Impossible franchise, with a possible exception of the second one, but we don't talk about that.
Okay. April, you've seen it as well. Do you echo the guys here in kind of loving it as much as they did, or how did you find the film?
I've only ever seen the first two, so I was coming at this sort of blind in a way, and I really liked it. I wasn't lost at any point. I mean, there were double agents, triple agents, quadruple agents. I didn't know who was screwing over who, but it was fine because there were car chases, helicopter chases, punch-ups.
Yeah.
It kicked a lot of butt. I enjoyed it very much.
Is it too much about that, though? The kicking butt and the bam, bam, action, action?
Yeah, the first Mission Impossible film, which, let's all remember, is 22 years old
this year. Thanks, Rowan!
I think that one had a little bit more of the sort of like the spy aspect. This film very much relies on enjoying the explosions, car chases, helicopter chases, masks, you know, fights, shootouts, things like that. I mean, we've all seen the trailer. That's what they know they're good at. So I think, yeah, if you're expecting a subtle spy thriller, this is probably not the ticket for you. But if you want action with a little flavour of spy thriller in there, then yeah, this is a great one.
And there is a lot of kind of spectacle in it in terms of the...
There's always that one stunt now where they've made the films, like, you know, climbing outside of the Burj Khalifa and then in the...
Hanging off the plane.
In Rogue Nation, he jumped down into the well as And then this one, it's like, let's give Tom Cruise a helicopter, sit back and just
and
watch.
Just enjoy.
Watch what happens. And you know, there's some part of it needs to be respected because he learned how to fly the helicopter so he could do as much. Although in the words of most of the other cast, it's because he's also just a little bit crazy possibly to be doing these things, because Henry Cavill's like... He was interviewed and he says, I watched one of the things Tom Cruise did and then I ran out of the room and was a little bit ill. I was like, oh boy, okay, really? And he's like, I'm not going to do that. That's why I've got a stuntman. And that is something that has increased as the series goes on, is the scale of the spectacle and stuff. And you're right, it does mean from the first one was so twisty and turny without a lot of fight scenes or anything happening. In fact, in the first one, you could almost say the fight scenes are even more realistic, because I seem to remember people get knocked out when they're hit in the face.
Yes.
Whereas in this one, it's like you have to be hit in the face 20, 30 times by Superman. And then you might be unconscious for 2 minutes. But otherwise, it's not a lot to stop the bad guys, it seems.
But is it? Does it not kind of lose the essence of the first films by not being so much the spy thriller anymore, by being the kind of action-packed, let's shove in loads of fight scenes? Because Mission Impossible, initially, it was all about the spies, and now, I don't know, I felt like it's not so much about the spies. I mean, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but what does that do for the franchise?
I think that, I mean, the trouble they probably have is that they don't want to come across as imitating the Bourne movies, which I think are the films that have moved into that slot, and they've done so fantastically well, because Mission Impossible, there have been a few wobbles. I know Rowan doesn't care too much for 2, whereas I think it's brilliant, and I don't care so much for 3, which is actually a shame, because I think 3 goes back to the idea of more plot over everything else. You know, one big set piece on the bridge, not much else. Whereas the Bourne films have been consistently awesome spy thrillers with one spectacular car chase per film. And they realise that. And Matt Damon, you know, just grabs a magazine to do a fight. And that's all he needs to do. And they're very clever that way. And Mission Impossible, I think, has looked at this and said, I think people need something a bit different. So let's go big now. Let's go home. Mm. And they're doing it very cleverly because they're keeping all the characters interesting. I've always found that in the Bourne films, Bourne's great, but everyone else is just kind of, okay then.
Yeah.
Whereas in this one, you know, Sean Harris is the villain, you know, kind of embracing this apocalyptic manifesto is absolutely brilliant. You've also got Vanessa Kirby turns up for the first time as the White Widow, who I think, and again it links back to the first film, is Max the arm dealer's daughter from the very first film, and it's just all this kind of history and backstory that they've brought back in again. And I was like, oh, this is really quite impressive. Now go and blow something up, please.
I was just about to ask that, because I think the characters are actually quite interesting in this film, which sometimes in these films, like you say, the Bourne films, perhaps they aren't. And we've got some returning characters, as you say, but we've also got some new faces. Would we like to see them stick around if there's going to be a Mission Impossible 7? Which there probably is.
I do think that, I've forgotten the actress's name, but Vanessa Kirby, is that
yes.
right?
Yeah.
She could certainly make some hay as a returning villain. Or semi-villain. Is she a villain? Is she not? It's difficult to know.
She's like Max. She's playing both sides. I thought Angela Bassett as Erica Sloan, the head of the CIA.
I agree.
You know, she was there as kind of like the counterfoil to Alec Baldwin's Mr. Secretary, who runs the IMF. And I thought she did a fantastic job, because if anyone was going to be more duplicitous than everyone else, it was her character. And she consistently was, all the way down to the end. You know, it looked like she might actually be doing something nice, and I was still like, I don't trust her. I don't trust her. This doesn't... it was absolutely superb. There was one other point I wanted to make, and that was on the music by Lorna Balfour. I've always found that in the Mission Impossible series, you get the theme, and then you just get background music. This time around, there's actually some really nice motifs littered throughout, callbacks to the original film, callbacks to the third and fourth recurring themes. So the soundtrack has also kind of stepped up this time to just punch the franchise up a bit. It's really good.
Great. You won't have seen this, listeners, but I just did a little dance because Dave mentioned Angela Bassett, and I think she's absolutely fantastic. So are we happy for another one quickly?
I feel like this was a swan song. I like this being the end.
Okie dokie. There we go. Mission Impossible Fallout opened this past Wednesday and is now showing at both Cambridge's Light and View cinemas. It is a certificate 12A. That's all we have time for on today's show. As ever, the past hour will be repeated tomorrow at 2 o'clock. Then our podcast will be released on Monday. That can be downloaded or streamed from our page on the Cambridge 105 website. We're also to be found on iTunes. We're back in a fortnight's time on Saturday, August the 11th. That show should include a review of Ant-Man and the Wasp, the last Marvel movie of the year. Plus, there's Hearts Beat Loud, a coming-of-age drama with Nick Offerman. And there's a supernatural crime movie, A Sicilian Ghost Story. Plus, we should have more on the career of director Agnes Varda. Please stay tuned for Bookmark, or if you're listening to our repeat, please stay tuned for Classical Cambridge. But from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.